Lyle is a writer, musician, activist, and zine editor. He will be reading from his new book, On the Lower Frequencies, A Secret History of the City, at Reading Frenzy on Thursday, June 26th at 7 p.m. and at Pals on Hawthorne, Monday, June 30th at 7:30 p.m. This is Eric Lyle.
My book, On the Lower Frequencies, is a look back at the past 10 years of my involvement in various fights against gentrification and the war with different communities here in San Francisco. This book covers a period of time starting around the dot-com boom that saw so much displacement and gentrification here in San Francisco, and takes us up through various progressive struggles around the start of the war, 2003, and the shutdown of San Francisco that protesters were able to bring about when the war actually started. Along the way, there's a lot about living in SRO hotels and abandoned buildings and squats and writing a history of this era from the ground up and looking at, you know, living this life in wartime and in this economic situation, what that life is like for those of us who are nearer to the bottom of this era. I've lived in San Francisco for most of the past 15 years. Yeah, you know, I was lucky when I showed up here. I had older folks around that, you know, told me really good, colorful stories about San Francisco. And I've always had a sense while I've been here of different people's histories overlapping. I've kind of kept these stories in my mind, and when I'm out riding my bike around the city, I can kind of see the different layers together. I can remember a street corner where there once was a punk club, and then there I was standing there years later in a protest, but also so-and-so told me that maybe they broke up with their boyfriend there in 1988, and I can just kind of sense these layers overlapping, and a lot of the book also as a, you know, subtext is about this archaeology sort of urban life, about how these layers of personal history are kind of always present in the streets, and about how the past informs the present, how these personal moments go to make up a sort of history of a city.
When you're talking about that in the book, it also leads into that the people on the streets are the ones who don't get their history written down.
Right.
And you, as a journalist and author, are not only writing down your history, but the history of those communities that you're part of.
Definitely. This is an attempt, you know, the book is also called, it's called On the Lower Frequencies, A Secret History of the City. You know, definitely this is an attempt to talk about different people's resistance and fighting back, and also our perspective on life, stuff that's getting left out of the narrative. I see what it's kind of about control of the narrative in San Francisco, and which way the city's going to go. You know, the old families and the corporations that have always controlled the city have this utopian vision of total development that they're always striving towards. They want to clear out the neighborhoods and they want to build more office space, and they're going to clean up the streets, and they're going to, you know, have more tourists and, you know, more service economy, that kind of thing. And then those of us who are in the neighborhoods who are living have this vision of, like, you know, we want more bike lanes, we want a traffic-free market street, we want affordable housing, we want free health care. You know, this is like the kind of city we want to see. We want to see green spaces, we want to see the creeks that are buried under the streets, daylighted. There's a battle, and we're not quite winning that war, so our history doesn't always get written. So this book is about writing the history sort of a republic that hasn't even really been quite born yet.
And I think the strongest example of you taking control of the narrative where other people wouldn't even question the official story would be with your the street paper that you started, the Turd-Filled Donut. So how did that start, and how do you want to talk about the ideas behind the founding of it, and then reactions that it got from the people in the neighborhood who were appreciating the narrative that you presented?
When the Turd-Filled Donut started, me and my best friend Ivy had just moved back to San Francisco in the winter of 1997. We showed up and we were living in SRO hotel rooms on 6th Street, which is San Francisco's Skid Row Street. You know, we were on welfare and food stamps and trying to get ourselves established here in town. The climate in the city, you know, was pretty intense. Willie Brown was talking about using helicopters with night vision to root homeless teenagers out of Golden Gate Park. Anti-panhandling stuff was getting really strong. So the poverty issues were coming to the top, and people would come and write about 6th Street, too, as a place that needed to be cleaned up. People were always coming as outsiders and trying to talk about this alien race of people that live in this poor neighborhood. And this was a neighborhood that I lived in that had public spaces and neighbors and friends and donut shops. And despite the hard times people were having, there's also a lot of sweetness in that life. And I felt like I wanted to put out a paper that would write about what our daily life was like, not always talk about how awful it is, but then also to kind of highlight political struggles too and examples of people that had organized as tenants of SRO hotels to like fight back. We did our share of directly confronting the mainstream media at that time too, because you know they're putting out all this hateful stuff about homeless people and hateful stuff about our neighborhood. Now Mayor Willie Brown at that time had a program where His Highness the Mayor would actually come down and meet with his subjects once a month. You could line up at 5 a.m. in front of City Hall, and the first 25 people would get a ticket, and they'd get a chance to meet with Willie later that day and speak to him about their concerns. So Ivy, co-editor of the Turnfield Donut, she got the idea that we would ask people on 6th Street what they would want to say to Willie if they had a chance. She told him she was taping the whole thing, and it was an interview for our paper, but he didn't apparently take that too seriously. And it was in this interview that Willie, he told Ivy, well, you know, people who don't have enough money to live in San Francisco, they really ought to just consider leaving. Pretty shocking quote coming from the city's first African-American mayor, who is presiding over this historic displacement of African-Americans from the city of San Francisco. You know, he was just saying, like, tough breaks, time to get out of town. This quote ended up being picked up by the Free Weekly, and then it was on local radio, and it became this kind of well-known thing in town that Willie had told everybody they just had to go, and it became part of his opponent in the next mayoral race, Tom Amiano, a progressive. He used it in his campaign literature, so that was a success right from 6th Street. And Turnfield Donut was bringing that news in. Part of the situation in the dot-com times was that we're under so much attack, and we were losing our spaces, and there was no place to meet, there was no place to hang out, there was no place to do art or music shows anymore. You know, people were fearing for the loss of their homes. We kind of had to use every kind of marginal space available to us to stay visible, and that was our first way to kind of combat gentrification. The Turnfield Donut appeared, among other places, out on the streets. We had stolen newspaper boxes. There were graffiti artists and also the San Francisco Print Collective, who were print poster makers. There were people who were trying to do a lot of public art. Through public art, you can actually sort of create an audience. You could tap into a subconscious of a neighborhood. We were trying to use, you know, the walls of the street as a platform to speak from. In around 2000, Mission Anti-Displacement Coalition formed, which was a group of local Latino residents in the Mission District and artists and homeless folks and activists and people from all walks of life who were really trying to cross all the lines and come together. We all have in common that we're being kicked out. The MAC, as they were called, they were really all about letting the public artists go off in the streets and do stuff around the MAC's message. So I was part of a group of folks who did a lot of wheat pasting posters all throughout that time. One poster that was real popular just said, "No nos vamos, you know, we're not leaving, we're not going." We would cover the neighborhood in this again and again, and having a real strong visual representation of resistance was real important.
When you have that, when you have the examples of the integrations of the scene all fighting against gentrification, and then earlier when you were talking about control of the narrative, you were talking about having green spaces and no traffic and bike lanes and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
When that happens in a city like Portland, it actually seems to be pushing out some of the liveliness of the street.
Yeah.
There's very little visual resistance.
Yeah.
Here, for instance. So do you have any comments on that?
Well, that is a major, major concern to me and a major conflict. It's not so much something that's in the book, but it's something I feel like that is more coming up in the future. San Francisco faces the prospect of being the first entirely gentrified city in the United States. A very limited amount of land, which is partially why the housing is so expensive here. Division between rich and poor is so extreme. Working class people cannot afford to live here anymore. There's very few parts of town that you would call working class anymore. Just on election day the other day, this horrible local measure passed that authorizes the redevelopment of the Hunters Point neighborhood, the last African-American neighborhood in San Francisco that's way out on this peninsula at the very, you know, most remote reaches of town already, an area that already suffers from extreme pollution left over from the Navy Yard and from various industries. The conflict, which, you know, in San Francisco, beautification has kind of always turned out to be exclusion. And I see that as a major challenge to people with progressive agendas, to like figure out how to like pursue an environmental agenda that's really, really strong on other fronts. It can't be like a racist environmental agenda that like promotes parks and bike lanes at the expense of poor people's housing, you know. It has to be truly for the betterment of all. It's easy to go halfway and live this sort of Whole Foods life, you know, maybe over like Seattle or something, you know, where everybody's against the war, but, you know, it's like illegal to sit on the sidewalk. And the neighborhood like Hunters Point is a classic example of a place that, like, you know, people from the community could be employed to be part of the environmental cleanup of that neighborhood. That's what needs to happen down there, is environmental restitution of that area, for sure. That can be undertaken in a number of ways. So it could be cleaned up for the benefit of some future, you know, upwardly mobile people who are going to move in there, or it could be cleaned up for the benefit of the people who already live there. And that's something that San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, places like that really need to look at. But I do think that those other things that I mentioned earlier, I think transit corridors instead of parking garages, I think that you are talking about things that are for the betterment of everybody.
I think you can be, for sure, but I also have seen it not.
Right, for sure. You know, some people who have read the book have said, well, you know, it seems kind of like you're applauding that there's, like, people crapping in the streets or something. And it's like, it's almost like you're cheering it on, you know. Unfortunately, that's the situation we're in, you know. The way things stand right now, it's like as soon as things start to get a little bit better, they take it away from us, you know. So it's like, how do people organize for the betterment of their neighborhood without actually, quote, beautifying it, you know, for the benefit of some future displacers? That is a real challenge. I think it's a big deal.
You are listening to an interview with author Eric Lyle about his book, On the Lower Frequencies, A Secret History of the City.
The 949 Market was like a larger group attempt to take a place in the dot-com era?
Yeah, kind of at the tail end of that. Like, we'd spent so much time fighting back in the dot-com times, people were just so exhausted with being the victim all the time. Every artistic depiction that people were doing of the time was like cops beating up guys with shopping carts, you know. It's like, after a while, you're like, I'm this person who's always getting beaten up. So we weren't really doing anything very assertive. And in the beginning of 2001, a bunch of us artists and activists who had kind of survived the dot-com era, we looked around and saw who was still left, and we got together to take over a different enormous abandoned building on Market Street at 949 Market, which is about a block from the cable car turnaround in downtown San Francisco. We took over this former billiard hall next to an abandoned theater. We went in there just thinking we could do a one-off hit-and-run show or something, but then the idea of having that much space in a time where none of us had had any space, you know, kind of allowed us to dream a little bit. This piece I'm going to read comes from a magazine that we gave away on the opening night of the 949 Market space. I made this zine that would sort of explain to people what the space was and what we had done to get it ready. So this is from that zine from March 2001. We wanted to do shows or art events that were more about what we're for than what we're against. I'm not saying we shouldn't protest. George Bush will certainly keep our hands full with that for these next 4 years. I'm just saying that I'm tired of being expected to self-identify as someone who's under attack, someone who is powerless and who's being forced out. We wanted to do shows that asked, what do we want the city to look like? How can we make it happen? If we really had all the space that everyone says they need to do stuff, well, what exactly would we do with it? we wanted to do shows that remind people of the power that they actually do have together. First, we had weekly meetings to generate ideas. Could we paint illegal murals in broad daylight that were so big that everyone would just assume that they were legal? Or what about breaking into mission houses where the tenants had just been evicted and having punk shows with kegs and spray paint? We were trying to come up with ideas of how we could take public visual space away from for-profit advertising, or how to take housing stock out of for-profit real estate speculation. Now, you might think it's easier to meet and come up with these ideas than to actually carry them out. However, when I reached my 6th month of having no home and I considered my dwindling prospects, I was reminded of how decisive action is so much easier when you don't have any options. When I heard about a vacant 2-story Victorian house with electricity and running water on sunny Shotwell Street in the Mission that was scheduled to be torn down, I cheerfully dusted off my old crowbar and bolt cutters, and a couple days later I had a new place to live, a squat. There's really no such thing as an abandoned building in the Mission these days. Every precious square foot is priced, taxed, owned, rented, coveted, and ultimately police protected. But this turn-of-the-century Victorian, with its fancy old wood floors, was available for the moment. According to the work permit that was stapled to the front door, the house would soon be gutted and turned into an expansive, one-story, loft-like cube with a massive parking garage inside where the first floor currently was. Only the historic facade would remain, leaving a feel-good SF postcard look that is in fact mandated by a strict preservation law. And my dim hope was not that I could one day own this place through obscure squatters' rights, but that there would be a stock market crash or an earthquake, something that would derail the developers' plans or cause them to run out of money before they could start to work, something like the inevitable shifts in history that market analysts have come to call corrections. Everyone has a dream about space in this town, a dream that hinges on real estate. We do posters and we put them up at the bus stop because we have nowhere to do what we want. We put on illegal hit-and-run punk shows at the BART station because we have no show spaces. We're always doing things that are kind of fleeting like that. But what if, instead of protesting all the time, we had all the time and space we needed to actually create something? What would we do with it? All I really wanted out of my new squat on Shotwell Street was a quiet room to put a desk in so that I could just sit and write. But the young gutter punks who moved into the upstairs unit were thinking much bigger. They printed out a copy of the so-called adverse possession law from the internet, and they started making 5- and 10-year plans for our new house. Looking out over the empty lot behind the squat, last week's 5th and Market Street drinkers were transformed by the dream. "We could turn this lot into a community garden," they announced. "We'll build a fence, we'll paint murals on it, we'll turn this squat into a community art center where little kids can come after school and paint." It was pretty ambitious. But what is a dream about space but a dream about who we might be? What is a city if not the aspirations of the people who live in it? This, of course, made it especially poignant when our, quote, community center was rather unceremoniously evicted by a single cop and a handful of weathered old Irish construction workers a mere 2 weeks after we moved in. On eviction day, I was invited next door to commiserate by a sympathetic neighbor. "It's a shame," he said. "Those kids were dumb, but I kind of liked them. What's going to happen in that space anyway? They're just going to gut the inside and take out all that history. They're just going to leave a facade. What's that, a Hollywood set or something?" He talked about his own work in the neighborhood. "I'm a builder," he said. "When I go into these old houses around here to work, I see how well made they are and how old the wood is. It's overwhelming. I just think, 100 years, how much has happened here? How many people have lived in these homes in that 100 years? You ever think about that?" I told him I did all the time. I thought about the Mission District houses, built with trees brought over from New Zealand because Northern California had already been deforested by the turn of the century. I thought about the different layers of time on these streets, all long gone, but all also still there at the same time, like rings in a tree. After my squat on Shotwell Street got busted, I found another place to stay that wasn't an abandoned building. But it didn't last, and soon I found myself once again helping break into an abandoned building to launch a dream. This time, it was right here on Market Street, the site of this show. We had been wondering about this space for years, really, but once inside, we weren't prepared for how great it really was. It was much bigger and better than we could have even hoped for in this political climate. Practically a block-long room, we could do anything with it. It was in a perfect location, too. The guys in the alley out back didn't care if we had bolt cutters, and there really were no other neighbors after dark. The block, like all of Market Street, really, had been mysteriously hollowing out for years. until even the sandwich shop in the ancient St. Francis Theater next door were the last businesses to go earlier this year. I spent an afternoon poring over dusty books on the fifth floor of the library, finding a photo from 1925 that may indicate that the space was once a piano company showroom, but it's hard to tell. I was definitely able to chart the history of 949 Market back through 65 years of tenants, as far as 1935, though, when SF Billiards apparently opened on this site. Later, a 1948 ad in the San Francisco phone book announced, SF Billiards, largest in the West. We serve sandwiches and beer. Women welcome. In the 50s, the space had a couple-year stint as a Vic Taney workout gym, but health and fitness were never big priorities down in mid-market, and soon it lapsed into a comfortable seediness as the home of Palace Billiards. Palace Billiards used the spot until its doors closed for the last time, apparently, in 1988. A sign taped to a countertop and doors announced, hopefully, check newspapers for a new location. But there wasn't a new location. And the only place the name Palace Billiards is known today is where it's laid in the tiles in the doorway, tiles hidden by a roll-down door until tonight. For 13 long years, 949 Market has been empty space. 13 years of vacancy, probably part of the owner's tax revenue scam, where the big empty room silently fills with dust that somewhere outside the city, a bank account fills silently with money. 13 years of vacancy while people dreamt about a space. What would you do with a block-long chunk of open space on Market Street? Is it more important to use it for housing or entertainment? Would you spend a month working on a space that might only last for one night and maybe not even that? Should a space like this just be opened and used to do a massive feeding for the homeless guys who live out back in the alley? Or should it be used for a punk rock art show? Can a space that's legally open really be open to everyone safely? What would you do with a block-long space on Market Street? We asked 10 or 15 people to come down and look at the space to help us imagine what to do with it, and then we went to work. The space needed everything from power and lights to vacuums for all the dust. And we found almost everything that we needed right next door in the abandoned St. Francis Theater. With flashlights and dust masks, we went on expeditions into the eerie silence of the old theater, out of the sun and swarm of Market Street and into a dark calm at midday. The theater unfolded before our flashlights like a movie, one shot at a time. A movie where we were the only survivors of a nuclear holocaust, where we were the beings sent from the future to investigate the past. We searched for fuse boxes and water pipes to turn power and water on. We found ladders, light bulbs, cans of paint. We found curtains and old signs. An old theater sound system was found, and we rewired that to build our PA for the new space. There was a hose for water. We found popcorn containers that we decided to serve our free food in. There were theater seats to sit in. Every piece of garbage in the old theater could theoretically be rigged to build our new show space. Slowly out of the theater's past, a future developed in 949 Market. We walked, even rode our bikes, excitedly around the room, saying, this is where we'll serve the free food, this is where we'll paint the murals, and this is where we can build our new theater. But as the space began to take shape, I found myself spending more time exploring the old theater instead, savoring that feeling of walking out of a downtown day and into the dark, into a place where time stands still, the feeling of going to the movies. Poor old St. Francis, screens now dark forever after over 75 years of movies, and there wasn't even an article in the paper when it went down. It started out as a silent movie house with a grand marquee, but its years on the main drag wore it down. In the 60s, it still had its name in lights, down and out but proud like an old man leaving his SRO hotel room in his best suit and hat, only to sit all day at a bus stop bench alone. But Market Street took that too, and the theater wound out its days with second and third run films. Cheap matinees and theaters full of men with bottles sleeping it off in a forever darkened afternoon while the feel-good hiss of summer's past spun off the reel until time at last stood still. Deeper and deeper into the theater I went through layers of debris and history. I rummaged methodically through desks and management offices, finding family photos and receipts and licenses, great piles of unsold tickets. I found the negative of a woman standing on the deck of a boat left behind in a folded up envelope with the questions for the U.S. citizenship exam scrawled on it in English and Chinese. In the projectionist room, I found reels and reels of film and used heroin bags hidden at a desk. I imagined a down-and-out Market Street projectionist on the nod at his secret room while the projector fluttered and flickered in a sort of REM sleep. There were film cans and syringes, a in an old Coca-Cola trailer that I unspooled and watched in the dark with my flashlight. The trailer showed a cornucopia of fruit that slowly turned into a sweating, fizzing glass of Coca-Cola as the caption appeared one letter at a time. It's the real thing. Down in the basement, in silent rooms and narrow halls, deep under Market Street, I found silent movie projectors and mounds of dust, marquee letters and old posters, popcorn machines broken, cash registers from the 1920s rusted shut, and always piles of film, moldy film in rusty cans, never to be seen again. I look at the piles of film deep beneath Market Street, and I think of a near century of people sitting in the dark while movies showed, sitting in the dark and dreaming, mouth slightly open, waiting, people waiting at crosswalks, watching the fog come in, people leaning in doorways, falling asleep on trains, underground. I see the piles of unspooled film on the projectionist floor, and I think of a march filing past the theater during the 1934 general strike. I think of cop cars burning cinematically nearby after the Dan White verdict. I think of Gulf War marches, Rodney King riots, last century's subconscious ideas surfacing from the dark under the street, ideas that were fought for and acted out here on Market Street. I think of the ideas that could fill up a free squatted space on Market Street one mural at a time, ideas that could fill up the whole city. You're reading this with the benefit of hindsight, knowing how the show turned out, but I still don't know if in a few hours our plans will work or if we'll get shut down and arrested in minutes. I'm on Market Street, where the layers of history are all hidden but still there like the rings of a tree. I'm in that crowd, leaning in doorways and falling asleep on trains, underground, waiting for the inevitable shift in history. I'm in the front row at the St. Francis in the dark, mouth open a little, dreaming. About 600 people came to this opening night, and it was real powerful at that time, such a group feeling of going through this time together and just being under attack, and then to make such a powerful assertion of the world that we wanted to live in. It was really great. After that, we kept the space open, and we managed to hold on to it for another couple months. So kind of the main message of the 949 Market, you know, and the groups of folks from that continued to work together was just like, you know, trying to make events about what we're for and not about what we're against. So I think that's a real feature of the kind of events a lot of folks put on here in San Francisco, you know. Well, it was kind of like my book release show, which was on May 14th. We had free vegan food for 100 or so folks, and we had speakers from the Coalition on Homelessness and the San Francisco Needle Exchange, because they're in the book. Somebody from the Alamany Farm came to talk about how they had taken over this abandoned farm in the city a couple years ago and started farming it until they got sanctioned from the city to actually legally be there. There were free zines given away, bands played, free patches were given away, free art. So it's kind of a trademark of a lot of San Francisco events to bring a lot of people together to share things for free and to feed each other and to create this vision of what we want in these spaces when we can get them.
You are listening to an interview with author Eric Lyle about his book On the Lower Frequencies, A Secret History of the City. Thursday, June 26th at 7 p.m., Eric Lyle will be at Reading Frenzy, 921 Southwest Oak. Monday, June 30th, he'll be at Powell's on Hawthorne, 3723 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard at 7:30 p.m. You can contact Eric Lyle through the website onthelowerfrequencies.com. Background music provided by Dead Moon, and the interview and production work was done by me, Erin Yankee.